And an entrepreneur looks at every problem as an opportunity, not something that's, oh my God, I have to deal with this now. It's not unique what any of us are dealing with.
There's no problem that you've had or anybody else has had that somebody else didn't have before you. And they're all solvable.
Have you ever felt like there's a secret club of successful contractors and you're left outside? Want in? Well, you just found the entry door. Welcome to the Wealthy Contractor Podcast. Each episode, we pull back the curtain, revealing the stories, strategies, and secrets that top leaders use to grow their home improvement business and enjoy more success, more wealth, and more freedom. Discover more at thewealthycontractor.com. Now let's get into today's episode.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of the Wealthy Contractor Podcast. This is Brian Kaskavalsian, and with me today is the one and only Michael Hoy. Welcome, Michael.
Thank you. There is one and only Michael that I'm aware of that's named Hoy, at least in our business. The others are some woodworking guys. So yes, thank you.
Michael has a little company called Great Day Home Improvements, which we are going to be talking about. But I wanted to start off, Michael, with you sharing your story. I know you've got a great background. You've got a really interesting story. And then we'll get into, you know, building the business.
I live in Baltimore, grew up here, still live here today. I've moved a few times, but I keep finding my way back. Grew up with two very entrepreneurial parents. One owned a video rental store. This is before Arrow's and Blockbuster. And my father was a eighth grade dropout that had an auto repair business and was severely dyslexic. So in 1979, I didn't know it, but I was pumping gas in the middle of the night at my dad's shop with one of those cool change things. And it was a gas crisis. So I didn't realize till later that what we were doing was illegal, but he was an entrepreneur and did what he had to do to make a living. So
yeah.
Eventually, my parents, unfortunately, went through a divorce. It was pretty nasty. I moved in with my dad primarily because he just let me do whatever I wanted as long as I didn't get arrested. I got a wrestling scholarship in high school to go to Iowa. So I was pretty good at wrestling, pretty competitive. And I got run over by a car the day before my senior prom and got severely injured, broke a bunch of ribs, almost lost my foot. And that kind of put a kibosh on the Iowa thing. And after I healed, I went to my parents and said, yeah, I do want to go to school. There was no money to go to school. You had a scholarship and you don't have it now. So do your thing. So I had been working in a lumber yard at the time, part-time, and graduated at 16 and went to go work full-time in the lumber yard. And that's where I got started, a place called Ridge Lumber here in Baltimore, and absolutely loved it. I loaded trucks. I learned how to build loads. I was driving a forklift, probably illegally, but you know, when you're building loads of lumber for a home, it has to fit on the truck perfectly. So it's 13 2x4s fit across the forks, 6x8s, 4x8s, 4x6s, whatever it is. And you get it level. And I was pretty good at math. So I figured that out. I eventually worked on the counter and then became an inside sales rep to the outside guys. I was about 18 and loved it. I liked the sales part of it and asked to go on the road. And the sales manager then, his name was Frank Zambrano, told me I was too young, probably a little immature, and said no. So I got pissed off and left. And I became one of 84 Lumber's first outside salespeople. So that's where I got my outside sales start. Eventually became an area manager for them, 21-ish, and was learning to deal with people. There's a guy named Bill Myrick and Frank Cicero and Phil Randolph were still all mentors. I liked leading people, even though I didn't exactly know what I was doing. Eventually worked in the Wolf Organization, which was owned by Governor Tom Wolf of PA. End up at Carolina Holdings, running lumber yards for them. And then I got my wife, got married, had babies. And she said, you need to come home and help me with some diapers. So I got recruited by a company called KC to run their Pella organization. So they were a Pella window and door distributor. And they were about to launch something called Windows Made Easy. And at that time, that was Pella's delve into the direct consumer space. So I was doing that in the Baltimore, Washington market. And my current partner, Ed Weinfurter, was doing that in Cleveland at the Gunton Corporation, which was a Pella window and door distributor. And that's where I met Dave Yoho for the first time. Pella was really protective. So some of the sales processes that Dave Yoho was encouraging me to run was not what Pella wanted me to do. But we found a way to combine it and make it work. And we created a really significant retail business very quickly. And then 2008 happened. That was pretty devastating. I took some time off, tried to figure out why I was having a midlife crisis as early as I was. But I got recruited by Renewal by Andersen. And I moved to Chicago and ran that business. I eventually ended up working with the Coro locations, Grant Davis, another mentor of mine. And that's where the knack for retail kind of came in. I decided to move home. And then my current partner, Ed, called and said, look, Great Day is small business today. It's made up of patio enclosures and static windows. It's got 12 locations. It's had a rough go. I think we could really make this go on the sunroom side. Nobody really wants to be in the sunroom business. And I eventually said yes and joined Great Day. And it was 10 years ago in September. So bring us to Great Day. And we wanted to build a moat around sunrooms. The plan was not to build what we had built. That was not what we were going to do. We were going to do sunrooms. We were going to figure that out. We were figuring it out. We did an acquisition in Florida and Tampa called Hartshorn, and it was an extension of our current product. We were looking at window and door to diversify. At that point, we were probably $100 million or so. Nobody really knew who we were.
I didn't know you were that big back then.
That would have been 2019, 20-ish. In 2015, we were $35
million. Okay, so we're talking even more recent. Okay.
Yeah. COVID happens. And the timing of COVID was when every home improvement company was about to dump a shit ton of money into marketing. So what do? Do you spend it and get, or do you not spend it and you know you're going to get nothing and seal your coffin? So we got really aggressive. And as people started to pull back, I mean, we opened 20 locations that year, primarily in the South. It was messy, but we were off and running. And then end of 2020 into 21, you started seeing more folks come to market, right? So Aldex created Renovo. They had contacted us actually at that point as well. And my partner, Ed, who I just adore like a brother, he and I spoke more. He's like, you know, we could do this without being majority held by private equity. We saw what had happened to Brian Elias's business at 1-800-Hanson's initially. We saw what Summit had done to Champion. And we were convinced they would break our culture and our spirit. And we were able to go out, primarily my partner Ed, and find partners that were willing to be a minority to us and provide us guidance, but not run the business. And today, if you look at the top 10 qualified remodeler, outside of Window World, which is, I think, mostly franchise, we are the only one that is not majority held by a private equity. So we think that's some of the secret sauce. And could we be owned by a majority? Probably could and still do what we're doing. But we do think that what we built is because of an entrepreneurial spirit and that we actually run these things. We understand these businesses really well. You're a huge advocate for this. I mean, it's a people thing. It's about the people and the culture and the spirit. And the process and the pricing, everything else has got to be right. But if you don't have the right people, it really doesn't matter. That's what we've built this business on, is the people.
We danced around it here a little bit. And for those of you that don't know, Great Day is a billion-dollar home improvement company. How many locations do you have? Let's give people a little context. How many locations are there today?
Today, there's over 300 physical locations in about 125-ish U.S. markets.
Wow.
We've done a ton of acquisitions, right? We did Champion and LeafGuard and Englert and K-Designer and Apex and Universal Windows Direct. But about 50% of our growth has come organically and through greenfields. The rest of it has been through the acquisition, which we have put a ton of money and investment into greenfields there as well. So while we've done a lot of acquisition, we're about 50-50 split of organic versus M&A. And we're pretty proud of that. We think that's a really good mix for us.
It's impressive.
And it's hard, man. I mean, opening up a branch is, it's really hard. Well, this whole business is hard. The strategy is simple. You got to figure out your marketing. You got to have the leads. You got to run them really quick. And you got to have a good system to close. But doing that every day, the grind of it, the stamina mentally it takes for people, it's hard. This is a hard business to execute.
My thing is always that people deserve, if they do a good job, they deserve to make money. They deserve to make a profit, because that's one of the problems with this business, is that people will accept low profits. People will give up profitability this year just so they can grow their top line. And it's not always a good strategy. And so, yeah, I agree with you. It is a tough business. So let's go 2019, before COVID. You were $100 million company.
80 to 100, so we're in that range.
Did you greenfield first, which, for those of you that don't know, greenfield is basically opening a store from scratch, opening a retail location from scratch, not through acquisition. It's just, we're going to go into a new market, we're going to start marketing, we're going to hire people, and we're going to essentially open a new business. So did you start that way first, or did you start with the acquisitions first?
Greenfield first. So we opened from 2017-ish, after we got the model right, 15, 16, we started to do contiguous openings. Like, we had Philly, we opened up Harrisburg. We had Boston, we opened up Hartford. We wanted to move south. Look, building a sunroom in Buffalo in February is brutal. But building a sunroom in Raleigh, North Carolina, not so much, or in Florida. So I want to say we probably were close to 20 units, and it was all south expansion. So we really used the patio enclosures business as our platform of how do you greenfield properly? How do you create regions? How do you create opportunity to spoke and hub? And everybody's got an opportunity to grow with the business as it grows. There's not individual general managers in these things. Our thing is keep the overhead and G&A really low so that you have the dollars to spend to feed the marketing machine.
Yeah. Now, your lead product was sunrooms?
Yeah, patio enclosure is the brand. Yeah.
Wow.
Here was our thesis. So we thought everyone was running and felt and could see everybody running to bath, window, coatings, roofing, quick one day, quick turnaround, get your cash. And we were like, well, if we could do that on the sunroom side, which is a lot more complex, and we could process it well, get the cash flow that we needed to get to support it. And we make all the product as well, which most people don't realize.
I didn't know that either.
I mean, we make 80% of what we sell, window, door, and patio. So we're vertically integrated as well.
Oh, through Champion, through your acquisition of Champion.
We have Got Champion, okay. We have the patio enclosures product we make up in Northeast Ohio, Champion in Cincinnati. We have a plant in Tampa that makes all the screen room product for Florida. And then we have the Leaf Guard and a metal roofing plant with Engler up in North Jersey. So yeah, it's... we love the manufacturing part of this business as well.
Interesting. Okay. We don't recommend it to regular home improvement people.
Yeah, this
we
is
definitely do not recommend getting into the manufacturing business.
Look, if you had asked us in 2018, do we love manufacturing? We would have said, we're home improvement sales and marketing guys. We have it. We're going to find a way to leverage it. Post-COVID, with all the supply chain issues, we were we love the manufacturing.
You love it. Yeah. So sunrooms... was that your main, and patio enclosures, that was your main product?
85% of the business at that point. Static windows was the rest, and it's hard business. So our thesis was, if we could get that right, then we could enter into window, door, all this other stuff, and be able to utilize what we learned from that and build a moat around the sunroom business, because nobody wanted to be in it.
The home improvement business is tough. And if you're doing windows, doors, you know, one day bath, roofing, it's quick. It's easy. Like you said, high gross margin. Great. It's still a tough business because you got to make leads every day. But the sunroom business adds a whole new level and layers of complexity to the business. And a lot of people can't make that business work.
It makes you want to throw up some days because you got permits and engineering. And
since
William County, Virginia hates sunrooms because that's what the code says. And Denver is tough at times. And if you're on the coast, it makes it hard. But if you can get it right, boy, is it a really great business. And we try to put the customers first in everything we're trying to do.
Sure.
It's their favorite room in the house.
Yeah, makes sense.
So the emotion of it is very different. That, you know, the metrics around it, we're all measuring the same stuff, but, you know, a sunroom doesn't close at the same rate as a roofing job does. That's why I don't care as much about close rate. It's important. I care about that more NSLI or yield per appointment, because that's what pays the bills. That's your stock price of your sales team, if you get it right.
You were 80-85% sunrooms. We're still 2019. And you started your acquisitions when, in 20 or 21?
So the first acquisition was in 18-19, which was Hartshorne Contracting in Tampa. They do screen enclosures, pull enclosures. I mean, you're in Florida, so there's pull enclosures everywhere. We viewed that as a natural extension of the sunroom space and the outdoor living. So that was our first one, late 18 or 19. Great business. We still have it today. That business has grown tremendously. 20 was when we looked at Apex Energy Solutions, and we started looking at the window business, but what we weren't wanting to do was fight the traditional media model. So we didn't want to be, you know, creating a whole new brand or all the TV, all that initial investment. Apex was a fully, very tech-based canvassing model. And they had 10 locations based in Indianapolis. So we were just about to close on that when COVID happened. And we pulled back because who's going to knock on someone's door during COVID? And then we eventually acquired it at the end of 20. November 18th of 20 is the day we acquired it.
What came after that?
In early 21, you saw a lot of companies come into market. I mean, think, you know, New Pro and Larry Chavez's business, and you had Statewide and
Reborn, Tundraland.
All those guys were coming.
All of them. Yep.
And we'd all felt that surge from COVID, right? We just got hyper efficient with our marketing. And we were approached by private equity like everybody was. And that was the moment that we decided, if we're going to do this, why can't it be us that does it without being majority owned by a private equity? We wanted their money. We wanted their expertise. But look, private equity is really good, but everybody needs to understand their motive. They have a ton of investors that have given them money. They're looking for a very specific return in a very specific time horizon. And they're going to do whatever they have to do to get that. That's not a bad thing. We're entrepreneurs. We know how to entrepreneur. They know how to private equity. So finding that perfect blend of relationship, we felt like we needed to be in the lead operating, and we wanted them to help us figure out how to get the banking and the finance and all of that part right. And we found a partner in Little John out of Connecticut that has been exactly what we needed, fits really well with how we think. And they've been so supportive of us, but they're in the minority.
So you did bring in private equity, but you did it different. You'd flip the script, basically. You said, you guys are going to be a minority. You're going to give us money. You're going to give us expertise. You're going to let us go do what we do best, which is open new stores and make good, solid acquisitions, and then bring them into our model. Is there anybody, I don't know, is there anybody else? Well, there might be one or two other people that I know.
I think West Shore has a similar setup.
I don't want to name names, but yeah, I think his is similar.
We're all running in the same groups, by the way. So we all know each other. We all kind of know what each other has done. And I think that private equity, frankly, gets a bad rap. Some ways it's been deserved in some cases. But the entrepreneurs that sold their businesses to private equity probably also needed to learn more up front, because you just don't know what you don't know. You only sell your business once. I mean, there's three times in your life that you go crazy. Once is a divorce, two, you lose your job, and three, you sell your company. You go absolutely batshit crazy.
I'm going to replay that part for my wife, because that happened to me. Two and a half years ago, we sold, and I went batshit crazy after that happened. And this is the first time I've ever admitted it or talked about it here. But there's aspects of it now that I just realized 2.5 years later that I'm like, whoa, wait a minute. I didn't know how this piece was going to impact me. I'm still an investor. I did the other model where they're the majority, I'm the minority, and they run the thing, and you know they're doing great. But there were some things I didn't know going into it. So it's interesting. And then it does mess with you, because you go from, and I thought this was great. One of our private equity guys said, yeah, you go from a producer to a consumer.
Yeah, that's a really interesting way to put it.
Because every day it's about, okay, What are we doing today? What are we selling today? And then it was about, you know, how much money is going to the bottom line every month? And so it's like when you see that every month and it's like, okay, yes, we're doing well, we're doing well. And then all of a sudden, you know, but it, essentially what you do when you sell a private equity is you sell your cash flow, you sell your income, and it's gone from one day to the next. You could be making whatever, $10,000 a month, $100,000 a month, $1 million a month, whatever. It's gone the next day.
I've watched probably every one of your podcasts, listened to them all. You made a point earlier that, you know, you should deserve to earn what you earn. You deserve it when it's low because you've made choices or decisions that have created that. And when you're doing really well, you've made choices that have created that result. The one thing I've always wanted, like I want to jump in as I listen sometimes to go, tell this guy this. If your sales team doesn't believe that the price you're charging is worth it,
yeah,
you're screwed. So one of the questions that I used to ask when I was hiring salespeople was, tell me the most expensive thing you've ever purchased the first time you saw it and why. And if they say, well, I've never done that. I mean, I would shop around. I'm like, that person, not right or wrong, they just have a belief system that now we have to break. So we're bringing people in that are doing that, and they're not going to believe in people are going to buy today, or they're not going to believe in the price we're selling it for because they wouldn't be able to afford it. How the hell are they going to get anybody else to convince that it's a good choice for them? So your margin is very much dictated, not necessarily in what the sell price is, but how much you give your rep to give up and how you hold them accountable to accuracy, and their belief system in what you provide has got to be worth what they're selling it for. If they don't believe that, you're never going to earn what you deserve to earn.
I don't know if you've had these, but I've had 100 of these conversations over the years where people will say, you know, will say, hey, look, when you're growing your business, two things on your P&L grow, your marketing and your overhead. And so in order to protect your profit, what has to grow is your gross margin. Well, in most cases, what you've got to do is you've got to raise your prices. Your marketing costs are going up. Your overhead costs are going up. You got to pay for it somehow. It's either going to come out of your bottom line or you're going to pay for it up at the top. And so we'll tell people, hey, wait a minute. Look, you're growing. You need marketing dollars and you need more people. So you need overhead and you need marketing. You got to raise your prices. Oh, I can't do that. My salespeople will revolt. Well, then you got a problem.
Well, here's why they'll revolt. We make price adjustments in event. It shouldn't be an event. We should be changing the price all the time, up, down, all around.
You're the first person I've ever heard say that. And I think that that's brilliant.
We do a customer survey post every appointment. And we ask the question, did you think this was going to be more or less than what we quoted? Nobody's ever said less. 90% of the time they say more. It was more than they thought it was going to be. So it's always too expensive. It's been that way forever, because people don't know what this costs. So if you create an event and that's what the rep is hearing 99% of the time, not buying because of your cost, you're just raised the cost and now they think they're going to hear it more. It's natural. It's shame on us for creating an event.
You're right.
So just adjust the price as you go, and the price is the price and it is what it is. Mr. Rep, your job is to create trust, credibility, and rapport every time in the home. Present the customer with a solution to solve the problem they're trying to solve. Do it in a genuine way that they don't think you're ever bullshitting them. And I coach this to this day. Most people don't do it. But when you walk into the home and you built your rapport or you've done your warm-up, the rep should ask the customer, if there's any reason that you're not going to do something with us, will you be brutally honest and tell me? And they all say yes. Then you get to the end and they say, sleep on it, shop around, pray about it, whatever. If you created the bright environment, you should be able to say, remember earlier when I asked you to be brutally honest, will you be brutally honest? And they'll say yes and go, it's the price. And go, great. Now it's not the value. It's more than you thought. My job is to find a way to make it work for you. And that's where consumer financing and all the other things we do. So it's just got to be really genuine. And if the rep is in the home thinking about their commission check, or is financing going to affect me, or am I going to screw this up and my sales manager is going to deduct from me? If any of that shit's going on in their head, they psych themselves out.
We always say, especially around price, it's more of an issue with your salesperson than it is with the consumer. Because ultimately, if you do a good presentation and you build value and you educate and you show them how you're going to solve a problem, then it's just a matter of, okay, like you said, how do we make this affordable for you? And that's where financing comes in. And that's why probably 70% of what you sell is finance, just like all the big players. Yeah. And if you're not using financing as a tool in the home to make it affordable for your customer, then
you don't deserve to be there.
Or you're going to struggle. Or you're going to lose out to somebody that will offer financing.
But the owners of these businesses cannot say, well, gee, financing is an expense. Financing is not an expense. It's an investment. And if you're taking that expense and finding ways for your rep to basically pay for it so you don't have to, you're just raise the price to cover the cost of financing and move on. It's take all the bullshit out, all the drama, all those conversations don't have to happen because it's now no longer an issue.
You're absolutely right. And it's interesting that you say as an investment. It is an investment. And you're paying a few points and whatever it is, you're right. You got to account for that in your pricing model.
Your best reps have the highest close rate, the highest yield per appointment, and the lowest discount off of whatever your list price is. And then other reps can't seem to figure that out within the same organization with the same price, with the same support, with the same sales leadership. That's bad hiring, bad mentoring, bad coaching. These businesses run at the speed of the leader.
The speed of the leader. Yeah. Well, and you guys moved fast. Wow. You guys did a lot in 3 years. So you went from 100 million to what are you going to do this year?
I'm looking at my qualified remodeler list. We were just under $1.4 billion. We'll report $1.7 billion.
Does that include the manufacturing or no, that's separate? This is just retail.
Manufacturing is a separate business. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
We've been beyond blessed to one, have the partners and the financial support we've had. We have less like a really, when my kids were little, I used to say to them, like, do you guys have gas? And they'd laugh and, you know, and I'd say, no, I mean, do you have give a shit? Do you have true give a shit? Our team gives a shit. The majority of our team has gas. And we use this thing, if I can find it. So people ask us about our culture all the time. I wish I could say it was the same everywhere and it was perfect. It's not. But we use these things called the team commandments. So the first one on there is help each other be right, not wrong. So if you're in a meeting with someone and you're talking about a subject and somebody goes, we can't do that. Why would we ever be able to do that? We'll go, whoa, 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 whoa. We're not judging. How do we help that idea be right, not wrong? What things like, if in doubt, check it out. Don't make negative assumptions about each other. Help each other win and take pride in each other's victories. So we're a very low ego business. Many of these companies, this is not right or wrong. It's just what it is. They're lifestyle companies for the ownership. Look, the ownership's taking a risk. They put the money in. They're drawing a shit ton of money out. That's on them. I don't judge that. We don't do that. We just don't think that way. So I haven't built Taj Mahal buildings. We don't drive around in fancy cars. Our overhead and G&A is typically really low. If you want to spend $1 million on marketing and the data's there to support it, we'll write the check over and over and over again. If you want to buy a $500 generator, we'll argue a month about whether we need that generator or not. So we're just really disciplined in that regard because we believe every dollar that gets created should be reinvested to drive the growth. And if we do that, everybody wins. The customer wins, the employees win, we win, investors win, everybody gets to win. And that's the company's mantra. Everybody's got to win. And we try to live that. So our mindset is a little different than everybody else's. Doesn't make it right or wrong. But we're not taking giant distributions out of the company just because we've built a billion plus business. Every dollar of profit gets reinvested back into the business to drive to build something that's not been built. For us, the scorecard is not just what our income is. It's did we build something that nobody else can replicate and build? That's really what drives.
Let's talk a little bit more about the culture. Small organizations, the culture is essentially everybody's in the same space, coming in and out every day. And it's like, it should be easier to manage culture. Whereas in your case, you're spread out over hundreds of locations. How do you get people to give a shit?
So each one of the businesses, while we're all interconnected, we're all sharing, we're all doing things in concert, has an owner of the results, has a leader. So Champion has a division president. His name's Victor. David Rosser runs LeafGuard. He's the division president. He owns his P&L. His people have results that they're accountable to. But that group at the top, we are all aligned to our team commandments and how we're going to interact, how we're going to think, how we're going to do things. We all have the same mindset. So we use this term a lot internally that says we're going to be curious and not judgmental. And we preach that all the time. I mean, are we being curious and not judgmental? We're being curious and not judgmental. The other thing we use is this analogy of there's a book called The Leadership Fables of Attila the Hun. Most people would say, why would you ever read that? But Attila was actually a pretty amazing leader. Is he would get all his generals and lieutenants and they'd get in the tent and they would argue and fight about everything that went on and they'd make a decision together, no titles. But when you left the tent, if you descended, they cut your head off. And we tell that story a lot because if we're in the tent and we do this in our meetings, we're in the tent, we could talk about anything. Nobody's going to get pissed off at anybody. If you do, probably not the right place for you. But if we collaborate and if we make a decision together and you dissent, heads coming off. That's just how we operate. We're really collaborative and that starts at the top. I do something every month called Hanging with Hoy. So it's 1 hour, unscripted. We get as many as 800 or 1,000 people on it. I think that's been our top of the 5,000 full-time people we have. And I cover a subject of what's going on around the company for the first 15. Sometimes I'll have a special guest. And then it's completely unscripted questions and answer and culture building. They have me for 1 hour every month to throw at me whatever they choose. It's called Hanging with Hoy. Drew, our CEO, you know, I stepped down as CEO at the end of the year, planned succession. Drew has something called Unscripted with Drew. He does it every other week. And we're constantly trying to find ways to communicate the vision and the culture and what we're doing and why it's working. Not everything's coming up roses. We've got warts everywhere, just like everybody else. We have the same problems, same issues. We're not unique. Got more of them because we're big.
Yeah.
So we focus a lot on the leaders that are running this business have got to have the same mindset we do and really believe it at their core. And then that permeates throughout the organization.
You said a really important word there. You said collaboration. And one of the things that I learned when we implemented EOS into our business in 15 or 16 was this idea of collaboration. It's not about us looking for somebody to blame. It's not about passing judgment. It's not about, hey, that's your thing to do, not ours. No. Here's where we're going as a company. And if one of our metrics is off, then how do we all get together? How do we collaborate as a company, regardless of what your position is? How do we collaborate to make sure that we don't go off track, that we come back on track? And it makes such a huge difference in the culture because it's not a culture, you said also earlier, judgment. People aren't afraid of making mistakes. People aren't afraid of, oh my God, you know, this guy is coming and, you know, he's going to berate me and he's going to put me down and he's going to do this and he's, no. We are working together towards a common goal. I like that a lot. I love your 10 commandments too.
Yeah,
I like how it's focused on people, right?
Yeah.
All of those commandments are about the relationship between the people in the organization, right?
Look for ways to make new ideas work, not reasons they won't.
Yeah.
All of these are common issues in a business that nobody talks about when they come up. They're just awkward. I call those squirmies. So when I was a kid, you pick up a rock, you look underneath it, or a potato bug or worm, and you put the rock back down and go, I don't want to deal with that. All these things that people don't want to deal with, I call squirmies. So I'm like, let's just deal with the squirmies. They're awkward. They're weird. Sometimes, but if you don't have trust and people don't think your motives are good for everybody, you're never going to get anywhere on collaboration. So we just decided we're just going to be real. We are who we are. What you're seeing in me today is what everybody sees every day that I operate.
Well, in every interaction I've had with you, this is the guy that shows up.
I don't need to be something else. I am what I am.
And I love the whole no ego thing. That's a big thing with our Success Society group, our coaching groups, is that when everybody comes together, you leave your ego at the door. Nobody wants to deal with your ego. We're all here to work together to get better. And it's the same thing inside of an organization. It's like we're here. It's not a job. It is a job. It's a way you feed your family and all that. But it's got to be more than just a job. Otherwise, people aren't going to give it their best. They're not going to be their best.
We talk about the entrepreneurial spirit in our business all the time. And an entrepreneur looks at every problem as an opportunity, not as a pain in the ass, not something that's, oh my God, I have to deal with this now. First of all, it's not unique what any of us are dealing with. Any leader in this business has the autonomy to make choices and decisions that are going to help us move forward in a way that is positive. There's nothing they can do that we can't fix. If you're going to be wrong fast.
Yeah.
Don't keep being wrong.
Right.
Gottlieb says that a lot. There's nothing that anybody could do that we can't fix.
The business is the business. There's commonality in it. It's a formulaic business. There's no problem that you've had or anybody else has had that somebody else didn't have before you. And they're all solvable. And it's interesting when people make it a lot bigger than it needs to be. And they try and figure everything out on their own instead of coming to places like this and, you know, all of the resources that are available to them to get those answers.
We've got a ton of people in this business that all you got to do is call and somebody will help you. Kind of amazing.
What's the best advice you've ever gotten?
You know, I think that be curious, not judgmental, and really thinking about, you know, how you control your ego. Not everybody has an ego, but if you do, put it to the side. Somebody helped me along the way. There was lots and lots of people. And for whatever reason, I ended up at the right place at the right time more often than not. So there's this idea that you make your own luck. I don't feel guilty for any of the success we've had. If anything, I think we could be doing a lot better. I tend to be pretty hard on us. We just don't suck as bad today as we did yesterday.
Isn't that us, though? Isn't that entrepreneurs?
That's just kind of, yeah, I think
it's in our DNA.
I want my adult kids to have somebody approach them one day and say, your dad changed my life or made a difference in my life. That's, if you want to be proud of something, put your effort into helping each. I mean, I've read this book recently called The Go-Giver, not The Go-Getter, The Go-Giver.
Oh, yeah, I know that book.
I love that book. Give more than you expect it back, and if you do that, you're probably going to get paid more in whether it's real money or accolades or whatever it is that's important to you. The money in all this is important, but it's just part of the scorecard. And
yeah,
that's not what I'm focused on. It's not what we're focused on. We're focused on trying to build something really amazing that nobody else has built. We want to do it at a high level of profitability because we have people who deserve a return.
Yeah.
That's the outcome of all the other stuff we're doing. So we don't focus as much there as we focus on everything that builds the outcome.
So you're a grandpa. You're a young grandpa.
52, man.
I am not even close. Now, my kids are 26 and 23, both girls. And so they're not ready yet, which is good because I'm not ready yet. Addie is like, she can't wait to be a grandma. I'm like, no. I don't want to be married to a grandma yet.
So I have two girls as well, 26 and 24. You've met Megan, the 24-year-old.
Yes. She lives down here. Yeah, she's fantastic.
Yeah. So it's my oldest that just had this baby. They got married, and this is a honeymoon baby. We're pretty convinced. So they decided to go right away. It's awesome. My mother-in-law, who lives with us, she's a great-grandmother. She's been more excited than all of us. Now that the baby's here, we're all super excited. I'm glad I'm a young grandfather because I'm going to get to do things maybe that others
wouldn't. That's true.
But it feels a little weird to be a grandfather. I don't know.
I realized this last week. So my daughter lives in D.C., and she's about to go overseas. And I said to Addie, I said, God, it's so hard to parent adults. I had never thought about it until this until my daughter is like, she's high up in her career. She's doing really well. And it's like, wow, now how do you parent an adult?
Well, how do you parent adult girls? So
yeah,
you went through this. I mean, every idea, it was all females in the house except for me, including yep, the
me too.
She was a female.
Me too.
Every idea that you have that you know is the right thing and the advice you give, they would throw it up like a pigeon clay and shoot it out of the sky. Didn't matter what if it was right or not. So I would sit at the dinner table and do that. I would throw the pigeon clay and go, boom. Dad's idea is the dumbest thing ever. So you let the mom deal with the parenting of adult daughters and you just know that you're going to give advice that they're going to laugh at, even if it's the right advice.
So get this, Michael. I just found out yesterday that I actually parented my 26-year-old a few days ago when we were together. And I didn't know how I did. Had no idea. I thought I was doing the right thing. And guess what? I parented the shit out of it, apparently. So I'm like I was on a high last night when I heard about this.
Wow.
I'm like, wow, I actually parented good. So yeah, but you're right. Yeah, you're right.
Everything's stupid. I do. Everything is dumb. But what I've learned is my daughters are scared to death to disappoint me.
Yeah. And disappointment is worse than anger. I realized that recently too, that somebody said to me, oh, we're not angry. We're just disappointed. I was like, I'd rather you be angry. I could deal with that. I can't. The disappointment is like, it's heartbreaking, you know, even in business, it's like, if you disappoint a customer, you disappoint one of your team members, you know, let them be angry, but disappointment is like, oh, that means I didn't do my job well. You know, I didn't give you my best. And so anyway,
common stories to tell at some point about parenting girls through that stuff.
It sounds like you've done very well, my friend. You know, the most important decision any of us make is who we choose to spend the rest of our lives with. And it sounds like, you know, your daughter's well on her way.
I've been married 27 years to the most wonderful, patient, understanding woman ever.
Me too. Man, 27 years. We have that in common too. Look at that. Michael, I appreciate you being here. Definitely coming back for a part two. I'm going to have some pointed questions for you. I'm going to put you on the hot seat and it'll be fun. And I appreciate you, my friend, and continued success to you. And to all of you listening, I think this is another great episode. And until next time, this is Brian Kaskavalsian, and this is the Wealthy Contractor Podcast. Thanks for listening.
Hope you enjoyed this week's episode. For insights on skyrocketing your home improvement business and accelerating your journey to the success, wealth, and freedom you've always dreamed about, be sure to get your free copy of my best-selling book, The 7 Secrets to Becoming a Wealthy Contractor, at www.thewealthycontractor.com. And don't forget to follow us on your favorite podcast platform so you never miss an episode. See you next time.